All right, well, welcome everybody to the October Citizens Climate Lobby call. This is a call for people who are committed to having democracy work the way that it should work, which is the way democracy should work, is it should be a partnership between citizens and their elected officials. You know, most people take the view that there's too much money in politics and it's too cynical and blah, 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 and therefore they don't engage with their elected officials. But the people who are on this call are people who are committed to solving the problem and engaging on a regular basis. Let me also say, for those of you who are probably listening to the recording because of the high holidays, I do want to say happy Yom Kippur, and I hope you have an easy fast. And I also want to start by congratulating Peter Joseph, Gary Horowitz, and Liz Fisher, and for everybody who voted on the MIT CoLab proposal. We won our category by an overwhelming vote, so thanks everybody who voted on that. That was really a six-month effort by Peter, Gary, and Liz, and with some help from Joseph Robertson. So for everybody who voted on that, that's fantastic. It's really a remarkable document that we now have in hand, and to have it and be able to use it in other places is phenomenal. And for everybody who went through the process of voting for that, it's important. They're going to be attending the award ceremony in MIT, and we'll see what happens from there. I also would like to welcome the new group. So if you're a new group and you're new to Citizens Climate Lobby, there's from various different states, including places like Mississippi and Vermont and Arizona. So great to have you. Welcome, and fabulous to have you as part of the CCL community. Last Friday night, I was driving out to have dinner with my wife, and I was listening to David Brooks, the conservative columnist from the New York Times, and E.J. Dionne, the liberal columnist from the Washington Post, discuss the weekly events that they do every Friday night on NPR. And they talked about Syria, and they talked about Ebola, and they touched upon the Ukraine. And then it came to the UN climate summit, and I was particularly interested. I will read anything that David Brooks writes. I just think he's a very thoughtful guy and always tries to look at things from the biggest possible picture. And I have never read anything that he said about climate change, so I was interested to see his response. His response was pretty quick, which was to say the only thing that makes sense is a carbon tax. But then he quickly added that he didn't think anybody would support it because people won't support it once they find out their individual costs are going to go up. E.J. Dionne immediately jumped in and said, that's right, because you have to do it the right way where you send all the money back to households. Now, I think that a lot of the time when we're writing the over 1,600 letters to the editor that have been published this year, or the over 200 op-eds of over the 40 editorial board meetings, we're mostly thinking about Congress and Parliament, and that's correct. Those are people that we should be thinking about. But you are also influencing the influencers. So David Brooks and E.J. Dionne have very big voices, and clearly, I don't know if it was one particular letter or the volume of letters that you've been making, but clearly you got to them. Congratulations, great work. I know that that put a little extra lift in my spirit Friday night, leaving the car to go in to have dinner. Also, we have been completing our analysis from the June conference. And we have a counter-commonsensical way of rating where people of members of Congress stand. So, for instance, common sense would say an A or B is where we would want people to be, but actually our category is C or D is the highest category someone could be in, and A and B is the categories we do not want people in. So according to the debriefs from the forms that you filled after the conference, we now have 55 U.S. senators that fall into the C or D category. That doesn't represent votes. That represents an inclination in the right direction. And as you know, we need 60 votes to pass a filibuster in the Senate, but 55 means you're doing a phenomenal job of getting things moving in the right direction. Now, in the House, there are 188 people that are in the C or D category. That means in the House we need a simple majority, so we need 30 more House members. And again, this doesn't reflect votes, but it certainly reflects people inclined in the right direction. So that is definitely moving things in the right direction and something that we need to start getting in front of key people in Congress so that they know we're closer to being able to do something than they probably anticipate. And that's because usually all of the, you know, focus and interest and discussion is about where things are disruptive or where things people aren't doing something, as contrasted with us building towards actually getting something done. The one other issue that I'll mention is the single issue that was brought up most regarding meetings with members of Congress was the border. And that's whether the border as it relates to China and India or the border as it relates to WTO compliance. So you'll see this month's laser talk is designed to deal with the border. There's additional laser talks that we'll ask you to practice on the website. It was the most common area, so we will continue to add focus in that area. And remember, when we work on our laser talks, it's not just that you have good material when you go to write letters to the editor op-eds. It's not just so that when you're meeting with a member of the media or Congress so that we can make a persuasive argument. It's also to give members of Congress persuasive arguments so that when they meet with their constituents, they're more articulate on the issue. So when we ask you to practice, it's not just because of the arguments we want to make, but so that the information that we give other people so that they can make those arguments also. Okay, let me just check again. Adam, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Okay, fabulous. Great. I can hear you loud and clear, so that's great. So we're really, really happy to have Adam Browning from Vote Solar on. You know, we've had a lot of scientists, we've had a lot of economists on, and when our policy is enacted, what it will do is increase the rate at which we move over to renewable energy. And so I thought there would be benefit to have someone working that space to talk about some of the places where there are successes. And in particular, Adam has had success in markets where they're conservative leaning. So what I asked Adam if he would do is just tell us a little bit about Vote Solar, some of the places they've had some success. We hope to get as many questions as possible. So depending upon the time for questions, we'll start in Burlington, Vermont, then Lake County, Illinois, Seattle, Pasadena Hills, and Portland. But again, we'll see. Depends upon the questions and how complicated the answers are. So Adam Browning from Vote Solar, thank you so much for making yourself available, and can you tell us a little bit about your organization and some of the places where you're having success and solar is growing?
Right on. Thank you all for having me. I'm honored to be a part of this. So, quick background on Vote Solar. We are a 501c3 and C4 nonprofit. We've now got 15 people working with us around the country. We're headquartered in San Francisco, have an office, and by an office I mean a woman or a man at a desk in Denver, actually two in Colorado, also Florida, Pennsylvania, New York, and now Boston. So our organization, just quickly, is really premised on a singular narrow focus, which is putting in places the policies to bring solar energy to scale. Not that we don't like wind or energy efficiency or any of these other wonderful technologies, it's just that solar has some particular strengths, but it also, in order to get it, you need some need to think about it from a policy perspective. You need particular specific policies in order to enable it. The whole goal, the fundamental premise here, is that through scale we can bring down costs. Our hope is to bring solar into the mainstream. Traditionally, cost has been the largest barrier, and our operating premise was that how you get cheap solar is through scale. That is something that I would say has been totally borne out by our experience to date. It's an awesome example of how public policy can really live up to its promise and deliver the results it was meant to. So what do we focus on? We really focus on really two different markets. First, enabling residents, people, customers, energy consumers to generate their own power. To do that, we focus on state-level policies like net metering. We do a lot of work with rate design, the structure of the utility tariffs that allow people to get credit for their power. And in the early days, we did a lot with trying to develop state-level incentives for solar. The second area that we focus on is really trying to increase the amount of solar that utilities use at a wholesale level for their main generation for sale to all of their customers. And the tools there, also we focus at the state level on developing renewable portfolio standards, having solar-focused competitive auctions, having feed-in tariffs, things like this. They're really about driving wholesale markets for solar. And I was also asked to talk a little bit about where we've seen some of the success. So this isn't just a California or a sunny state issue, although this is where we have seen the most progress to date. Just a quick little background, we got our start 12 years ago. Solar modules were $4 a watt. And in California, we were having a lot of trouble with utilities that didn't want to see an increased renewable portfolio standard. So very focused premise of trying to enable customers to saying the message here is like, if utilities won't do the right thing, then let's put this question into the hands of the people and allow people to generate their own power using solar. So from that effort, we worked with many others to develop something called the California Solar Initiative, the CSI, which was a market-responsive system of declining incentives that got to the point where you didn't need incentives anymore. That has absolutely worked. Earlier this year, we're very close out of state-level incentives in California and the market here in terms of people putting solar on the rooftop is still thriving. In California, we've got a renewable portfolio standard of 33% by 2020. The utilities are already contracted largely on a basis to be in compliance with that already in terms of the contracts they signed. We're now at something like 5 gigawatts of wholesale solar. We'll probably put on another 2 gigawatts this year, and we're on track to be at least 10% solar on an energy basis in California by 2020. All of this is just an enormous success, but again, this isn't just a California story. So Mark asked me to speak about some of the traction that has happened in places with a real conservative bent, and this is one of the wonderful things that I like about solar is that it really has something to appeal to people of all sides of the political spectrum. You don't have to, we have a saying around the office, never choose someone's reason for liking solar. Let them bring their own reason to it. So for me, I'm motivated by climate. Others, may not be motivated. Maybe they hate the utilities. Maybe it's about independence. Maybe it's about self-reliance. Maybe it's about energy security. Whatever it is, solar's got an answer, and we really try to speak about solar in a way that allows people to bring their own reason to it. So you may have seen headlines over the past 6 months or a year or so about what's been going on in Georgia. And it's really a tremendous success story. So in Georgia, the utility charter is very strong. They have a monopoly there that prohibits the type of sort of rooftop solar financing that is incredibly popular, the Sunrun or the Solar City or the Sun Edison model, where a third party owns a solar system on your roof and you sign a long-term contract to buy that power at rates cheaper than the utility. It deals with that issue of having high upfront costs. It's enormously popular, and it's prohibited in Georgia. Tea Party activists there, libertarians, rightfully took umbrage at this idea of like a monopoly in collusion with the government, telling them what they could or could not do in terms of choosing their energy sources. And they've been enormously successful in driving a narrative that solar is freedom. There's a couple of Georgia public service commissioners, elected officials, who have really just tapped into that. Bubba McDonald is one of them. And as the story goes, the Georgia Power, it's the local utility, it's a southern company utility, one of the largest carbon dioxide emitters in the country. They had to come up with a solar answer, and so their answer was utility scale solar. So there was maybe 8 megawatts of solar in 2011. By 2016, there will be over 900 megawatts of solar. You've suddenly got the utility really on board with this just because the local political dynamic has fundamentally changed in favor of having a solar answer. Now, they didn't address the issue yet of allowing people to put solar on their own roofs, so that gives us still a remaining advocacy point to go forward. But we have changed the political dynamic down there, and the political dynamic is changed. And one more point, all that solar that Georgia Power is putting on is coming online cheaper than their avoided costs. That is, cheaper than their alternatives. This is a company that's still building nuclear plants. They'd love to do more natural gas, but they've calculated that, again, solar at this point is cheaper than their other alternatives. So if there's any takeaways that I just, if I wrap up my quick intro here, that I'd like to leave you with here, is that solar is now matured to the point where we really can say, like, we have the technology to deal with climate change. All we have to do is use it. And the other point, the corollary to that, is that dealing with climate change is not going to be this economic hurdle, this huge crisis of on our wallets. It's actually going to be an economically pleasant experience. By building scale, we can bring down the cost of these zero-emission alternatives to fossil fuels at points where they can deliver their benefits without that degree of pain in our collective wallet. So with that, I'll end my intro and happy to take questions.
Great, Adam. And hopefully we'll see. I mean, we were only able to list half the people who submitted questions. We'll see how many we can get to. Let's start with Rick in Burlington, Vermont. Rick, if you could *6 your phone to unmute it, then we'll go to Lake County, Illinois. Julie, I think someone had a question there, and then Seattle. So first of all, if you can *6 your phone, Rick, are you there, and does someone have a question? It takes a second sometimes, Adam.
No worries.
Okay, well, let's try Lake County, Illinois first, and then we'll swing back to Rick in Burlington. So, Julie, does someone in Lake County have a question? Again, what you would need to do is *6 your phone to unmute it. We may be a little bit unmuted challenged.
Mark? Julie,
yeah, go ahead.
County?
Yeah, go ahead, Julie. Go ahead, Julie.
I'm going to turn it over to Dave, who actually has the question.
Great, thank you.
Adam, thank you for joining us today. My question kind of is a growing question of concern, because out in Hawaii and California, perhaps on sunny days when they have a large amount of photovoltaic energy coming into the grid, sometimes there are problems that arise quickly. And I guess the question comes, do you see the Federal Regulatory Energy Commission setting up a policy that's going to help to regulate the surges that happen when renewable energy comes online? Or do you think this will be left to the state level?
That's a great question. So I think...
Lake City, go ahead and start to dispute it so we can get rid of the echo. Okay, go ahead. Thank you. Go ahead, Adam.
Much better. I worry that was on my side here. So, you know, what you're addressing here is the question of the grid integration of large scale of renewables that are intermittent. They're not the same type of generator as a dispatchable unit. And in most places in the country, that is unfortunately not yet an issue to be dealt with, just because we haven't gotten to that level of growth in renewables. In Hawaii, which presents its own problems, its own dynamics, because it's it's an island where grids are harder to manage. You have a situation where you're looking at distribution circuits really becoming maxed out, that they can't take as much at the end of the line. And so they're looking at a lot of ways, which include a lot more storage that will drive what goes forward in Hawaii. In the rest of the country, what is on our side here is geographic diversity. So if you see, one particular solar system, a cloud goes over it, something like that, it reduces its output rather quickly. That can look like a problem, but the data that we have collectively is, when you really look at that as it's deployed in real world conditions over a wide geographic diversity, those little blips tend to mellow out into something that is much, much more manageable. The solution here is through, again, really frankly, the widest possible geographic diversity of both generation as well as load. It's not just a generator that goes up and down. That's an issue for the grid. It's also when you turn on your dishwasher. That looks the same way on the grid as a solar system that goes behind the cloud. So FERC Order 1000 is a federal regulation that is really supposed to drive the states to look to regional solutions to have energy markets, energy imbalance markets. So in California in the West, you've got the California Independent System Operator, and then now joined with some in Nevada, and the next step is to hopefully have them join with some of the utilities in Arizona and then continue to go east from there so that you have just a much more collective sharing of both load as well as generation that makes those energy imbalances level out and much easier to deal with. So long bit of story to get to answer your question is that FERC has directed states to look at these types to work together and work to regional solutions. Getting states to actually do it is another question, and we've got staff that are trying to solve that problem. But the big takeaway is that there's a lot of work underway. It's eminently solvable. NREL studies, the National Renewable Energy Labs, show that this is solvable technically. It's just you need to have, like everything, both the policy and the politics to actually do it. But it's not a technical problem that can't be surmounted.
Okay, great. Let me check back real quick and see if we were able to get Burlington, Vermont. Rick, is somebody there?
Yes. Sorry, I pushed the wrong button on my phone and canceled the call.
Go ahead, Rick.
Hey, thanks very much, Adam, for coming and sharing your insights with us. I've got a couple of questions that I think will bridge your current work with solar technologies and your previous experience with the EPA. One of them is, in addition to net metering and other policies that you've mentioned and the economic incentives that we want to create, what other factors do you see contributing to the adoption of solar technologies and innovations?
Well, that's it's a great question. So a big part of it is the economics. And, the whole point of carbon legislation is to, put a price on the externalities, and that will, of course, be helpful to leveling the playing field when it comes to the economics. A lot of what we try to do, again, is provide access. Not everybody has a rooftop that they can put solar on. So we push policies we call shared solar. Some folks call it community solar, where you're able to buy a part of an off-site solar system or other energy and have the benefits of that credit back to your particular bill. So you'll be able to, just as if you put a solar system on your roof, fix your energy bill for 20, 30 years into the future. We've passed a law here in California and now still working to get regulations implemented. Colorado has one, a bill like that just filled up already, and we need to raise the cap on it. There's a lot of really interesting things happening in a lot of different states to enable that. It's worth noting that it's not just individual consumers, and I would put a fine point on this, is, you pull America, and citizens overwhelmingly want to see this transition happen. What we're trying to do here is provide the avenues by which they can take action on that. So again, it's not just individual consumers, it's also companies. If you look at Facebook, Apple, Google, these all have commitments now for going forward 100% renewable energy to power their operations. Google is growing faster than they've ever grown in their corporate life, which is a scary thought. And they will not set up a data center in a state unless they can get access to 100% renewable energy. And they're doing it because of the economics. So when they go to some of these states, they have to set up, new laws that allow them to, again, access a solar farm or a wind farm to power their data operations. Our idea is that what's good for the Google is good for the gander, and that it shouldn't be just a one-off for large corporations, but individuals too should be able to make that election to choose their sources of power in this way. So this is, you know, one of the nice things about solar in particular is that it's, you know, it's so modular, so scalable. There's a sort of a different solution for many different problems that are presented itself, and it's, we just need to develop the specific policies in order to enable them. Did that get to your question, or did I just talk about what I wanted to talk about and not what you wanted to hear?
Okay.
I hope so, Adam, because we're going to have to move on to another question anyway, so I hope you answered his question. That's always a good answer, though. Did I just talk about what I wanted to talk about, or did I actually answer your question?
if I could just interject to say that if anybody does have questions and we don't get to them, I'm adam@votesolar.org, and hopefully that can be passed around, and I will take the time to respond to anybody that does email me with a question.
Okay, good. And there were a lot more. So everybody, if you could say that email address, Adam, because we're that's going to be the public question.
Adam, A-D-A-M, at Vote Solar, the name, V-O-T-E-S-O-L-A-R, and then .org, or .org.com.
Okay, so for the about the rest of you, 10 of you who submitted questions, if you could go ahead and submit those to them, and if you think that those could be shared to the whole group, please put it on community. Adam, can you just take 2 minutes and say a little bit about what China and Germany are doing so that we know, you know, countries that we're kind of competing in this market, what the things they're doing to expand?
It's a great question, and, you know, we can start with Germany. We all owe a thanks to Germany for really having the foresight to identify the correct means to bring down the cost of solar. If they developed this feed-in tariff program where they established, you know, anybody that wanted to sell power to the utility at over a long-term guaranteed contract could initially at really high rates. It was like 60 cents per kilowatt hour. And then they gradually ratcheted it down, and now they're at rates that are well below retail rates. And so they're adjusting their policies going forward and are no longer, doing quite the same volume as they used to. But they've got over 35 gigawatts of solar on their grid at certain points in time, like sunny spring days when there isn't a whole lot of load. You know, the country has reached, you know, nearly 50% solar. It's really been, and that's just a snapshot in time, that's not overall. It's really been a wonderful success story demonstrating just the possibilities of what can happen. China, what Germany did by, you know, really revving up demand is it brought the manufacturing might of China into this game as well. They're now the company with the largest manufacturing base and has really been instrumental in developing the competition that has then brought down costs of making solar tremendously. And I would also note that the U.S. has not been left out of that. We've seen announcements for building new solar factories in the U.S., a couple of ones that just popped up in the last month or so, Solar City building one in Buffalo, Solar Frontier one in Buffalo, and some others. So China has also ramped up their demand. They've got a lot of large central station stuff, and now they're trying to develop a distributed generation policy as well. But they're looking at doing a significant amount, nearly 10 gigawatts a year. It's always hard to know exactly what's happening. Sometimes that goal is 14 gigawatts a year, sometimes it's a little less. But nonetheless, the place that is famously pointed to as people say, well, we shouldn't act on climate in the U.S. because what about China? Well, China's actually doing more solar than the U.S. is. So that excuse of, like, we can't act until China does is ringing rather hollow these days.
Great. Well, Adam, thank you so much. Our people obviously have a big appetite for what you're talking about. I can tell by the number of questions and more. So hopefully we can have you back again. And I know we were interrupting something important that you had to do with your family today anyway. So thank you so much for making yourself available, and hopefully we can have you back again.
Anytime. I love what you guys are doing. Keep up the awesome work, and please do reach out and email me if there's anything I can do to be helpful.
Okay. Fabulous, Adam. We'll take you up on that. Thanks a lot.
Right on. Bye-bye.
All right. Okay, good. So I want to bring Amy Bennett and Steve Balk on for a second. You know, we have our educational part of the call every day, every month. We have laser talks that we're hoping everybody will practice. And then we also, you know, the really the only thing that matters is that we're in action. So we're going to want to get a report on what we've done. And, you know, this is one of the greatest months in the history of anybody who's working on global warming, climate change. The march was a huge success. Well, we've reported on a group leader calls. Joe will touch on it in his report a little bit. But what we need to make sure is that something great happened in September just means that something great has to happen again and again and again. So I'm going to ask Amy to give us our year-to-date numbers. And then so that it doesn't just seem like numbers, I'm going to ask Steve Balk to read a part of one of the op-eds so that we remember it's not just, oh, yeah, there's just one more of those. It's never just one more of those. It's one really good letter after one really good op-ed after one really good editorial board meeting. So first of all, Amy, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mark.
Okay, good. And so can you tell us where we are year-to-date in some of the key categories?
Yes, Mark. So far, meetings with our legislators, members of Congress and Parliament, we have had 883 meetings. We've had 41 editorial board meetings, 45 editorials, 1,631 letters to the editor, 211 op-eds, and 4,136 personal letters sent to Congress.
Okay, really, really cool. And just to hit on a couple of those, you know, we talk a lot about developing relationships with members of Congress, but let's not underestimate the importance of developing relationships with newspapers. So, for instance, the people in Iowa have been developing a phenomenal relationship with the Des Moines Register, and that's not going unnoticed, Iowa groups. We're seeing the amount of activity that paper is reporting, and we know that's because of the good work you're doing of developing a relationship. Same thing with the people working with the Minneapolis Star and the phenomenal editorial in that paper. I know Gene Johnson, I imagine Paul Thompson had something to do with that, but that is just fabulous work that we're continuing to work based on developing a relationship with organizations. And in Canada, my goodness, Canada had 25 people at the march, just CCLers, really, really remarkable. We're within 21 letters in Canada of doubling our LTE total from last year. This month, a lot of our materials were translated into France, which is a bilingual country that's super important. And then, and many of you are aware, the Canadian conference is coming up in November, and we've already secured a meeting with the NDP caucus. So for all of you in Canada, thanks for just another great month. Really, really good effort also. Okay, and Steve Balk, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, Mark?
Yeah. Can you speak up just a little bit, though?
Sure. So, yeah. Can you hear me better?
Yeah, I can hear you a little bit better. And so could you just tell us, give us a little bit of one of the op-eds? I mean, all of the pieces are great, but so that people don't just hear it like, oh, yeah, we had 21 op-eds this month or we've got 201. Just can you read a little bit so you can people can hear the kind of communications people are making?
Certainly. Okay, so this was an op-ed that was in the Fresno Bee by Pete Moe, and the headline on it was Citizens Alliance has Solutions for Climate Change. President George W. Bush, in his 2007 State of the Union speech, said, quote, dependence on foreign oil leaves us more vulnerable to hostile regimes and terrorists, and clean domestic alternatives help us confront the serious challenge of global climate change. President Bush correctly noted that climate change, national security, and dependence on fossil fuels are a related set of global challenges. The U.S. Department of Defense recently released its 2014 Quinquennial Defense Review. Every 4 years, our military strategists attempt to predict future threats to our country, the causes of these threats, and a broad plan on how to deal with them. This year's report identifies the quote-unquote threat multiplier nature of climate change. These threat multipliers, quote, will aggravate stressors abroad such as poverty, environmental degradation, political instability, and social tensions, conditions that can enable terrorist activity and other forms of violence, end quote. Furthermore, Admiral Sam Locklear, theater commander of the Pacific, said to Congress just this summer, quote, climate change is the single greatest threat to security in the Pacific, except for North Korea. Henry M. Paulson, was Bush's Secretary of the Treasury when the economic crash of 2008 waylaid us all. In his words, quote, "For too many years, we failed to rein in the excesses of building up in our nation's financial markets. When the credit bubble burst in 2008, the damage was devastating. Millions suffered. Many still do. We're making the same mistake today with climate change. We're staring down a climate bubble that poses enormous risks to our environment and economy. The warning signs are clear and growing more urgent as the risks go unchecked." Paulson's answer to the problem of climate change is a fundamentally conservative one that empowers the marketplace to find the most efficient response. That is done, he says, by, quote, "putting a price on the emissions of carbon dioxide." And I'm going to stop right there, Mark.
Okay, good. So let me tell you, everybody, why I think that's so important. You know, if you're on this call very often, one of the themes, thank you for reading that, by the way, Steve, one of the themes you hear constantly from us is messenger is often more times important than message. And sometimes I think people would hear that like saying it matters who says it out loud. But no, look what he does in this piece. He almost says nothing himself. He says, here's what George W. Bush said. Here's what the Department of Defense Quadrennial Defense Review says. Here's what Admiral Sadmiral Locklear said. Here's what Hank Paulson says, and quotes them. So under the theme of messenger is often more important than message, this is a brilliant example of somebody using that where he was able, this is again Pete Moe, this is a fantastic piece in Fresno. Good job, Fresno. To really take that theme and get a lot of other people's voices out there. And again, I also wanted to read it so you don't think when we say there was 21 op-eds this month that it's just some number. It's another penetrating, effective piece, one after another. Okay, we want to get a quick international update from Joe Robertson. And he's also going to touch on what happened at the climate march. So first of all, Joe, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, so Joe, we had our first piece in a Serbian paper last week. What did that piece say?
Well, it sounded something like this. Georgi Samadzija iz organizacije Zjedan Stepen Serbia istakao je neophodnost animiranja džave i društva za uključivanje.
Great. I'm sure that was a nice thing said about me, right?
Actually, it's about our local leader there, Georgi Samadzija, who's the one that got the piece published and was interviewed.
Great, great. What else is happening international? And then if you could touch on the march real quickly.
Sure. So there are CCL volunteers around the world that are doing things like what Georgi is doing. They're starting to meet with their elected officials. In Germany, our volunteers there are meeting with members of parliament and members of the European Parliament, as are our volunteers in Sweden. In Australia, our volunteers there responded to the government zeroing out the carbon price by going straight to the top, meeting with the environment minister, who's not only a supporter of pollution taxes, but is also responsible now for figuring out how to deal with climate change without a carbon price in place. CCL Bangladesh and CCL Nepal are teaming up to form an art exchange. There are artists in both of the main groups there, with the purpose of educating people in both countries in government and among the citizenry to motivate citizen engagement on climate change and a shared sense of purpose for dealing with their respective impacts, coastal and Himalayan.
Great. And then, and Joe, tell us real quickly about what you launched this week in conjunction with the UN activities and then the march.
Sure. So the bundle of everything treaty negotiation process has failed for 20 years. So we need something simpler, something like what Citizens Climate Lobby is advocating here in the U.S. and in Canada and elsewhere. So the phenomenal, game-changing work that all of you, that our thousands of volunteers are doing, got us a personal invitation from the U.N. Secretary General to attend the U.N. Climate Summit in New York just over a week ago. And right after we went there, we were joined by Dr. James Hansen at a side event that we hosted to launch our global strategy to get that simpler, more effective solution. Through the website pathwaytoparis.org, which launched that day, we will build a coalition of supporters, leaders, advocates, governments, businesses, and stakeholders to keep everyone focused on making the following principles the core of the Paris Climate Treaty at the end of 2015. A steady, resolute, and rising carbon price, internalizing costs incrementally, steadily, and with no leakage, simple, transparent, effective at reducing emissions, building economic value at the human scale, and easy to implement, country by country, harmonizing across borders. So we have the support of the World Bank's Vice President for Climate and her team, the leading climate advocate at the International Finance Corporation, the National Council on Science and the Environment, the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, the Pricing Carbon Initiative, and others around the world. We're going to be hosting a series of online forums and also side events at major conferences and summits so that citizens can engage directly with governments and negotiators and help to provide information to leading economists so that they don't miss these core principles that flow from something as simple and straightforward as the fee and dividend plan.
Great.
So
let me just let everybody know that you know, CCLUS is 100% passing a federal fee and dividend bill. CCL Canada is 100% focused on passing a national fee and dividend bill. CCL International is working on building an international coalition, and Joe, you and the international team, which is you, is doing a great job. So can you give us a quick report on the march also, Joe?
Yeah, I just want to say real quickly about the connection between the international and the U.S. You know, our message to Congress about the international process is that the president is going to be going to Paris to make a deal. And he says he doesn't have to consult the Senate. And he might be right on the law, but a lot of people in Congress are not happy about that. So if the U.S. Congress, especially the conservatives, want to have a say in how this gets done, they should pass fee and dividend in 2015 and send the president to Paris with a strong message to lead the world forward on this issue. About the march, I want to say some words about the amazing Ashley Hunt Martirano. A lot of people have been hearing about this, and you know, she had a team around her. But just for some perspective as to how all of this came together, Ashley was the chief organizer for all of CCL's engagement with the People's Climate March. Her work allowed more than 250 CCL volunteers to come to New York from around the U.S. and Canada. That's roughly the number of people who attended the first three conferences combined. Maybe a few more were at those first three conferences. They met hundreds of new potential CCL recruits, maybe as many as 1,000 people total. Part of Ashley's unique range of talents is that she builds a strong team and empowers volunteers to commit their time, talents, and energy to making something happen. And that team worked together to produce all the materials that were needed, to make sure the logistics were in place, to find the right places for everybody to organize. She spent upwards of 30 hours a week volunteering her time, and that's on top of a full-time job where, you know, hopefully I'm not revealing too much, but they've given her a co-worker's portfolio who is no longer there. So more than full-time, plus 30 hours volunteering, and all of that while she's bravely recovering from a bad car accident, coping with pain and numbness, and she's doing it heroically. She never complains to the people she's working with. She just keeps on trying to empower others and make this happen because she values what all of us are doing. And the way that CCL volunteers can lead each other and can collaborate like that, valuing each other's contribution, I think this is just an exemplary case. And Ashley and all of the people that worked with her really deserve everybody's deepest thanks and appreciation for what they were able to achieve in New York. And I just want to say, in addition to all of that, not everyone can give 30 hours a week like Ashley does or Jay Butera does or so many others do. A lot of CCL volunteers commit a lot of time. But what everyone should do is find their own level and do what is optimal for empowering themselves and expanding CCL's reach and relevance. It's crucial for everyone to just keep in mind, we're on the same team as people like this. People like this have our backs, so everything that each of us does is part of an effort that's going to make real change. And Mark, if you give me one more second, I want to read a quote from a piece that was written about Jim Grant. Jim Grant was the head of UNICEF for a long time. He took UNICEF from a place where they did small pilot programs in isolated villages and then made recommendations to governments to a global force for change for the good of children and for human development. On one occasion, Jim Grant asked the UNICEF representative for El Salvador why the immunization level there was failing to rise. The representative replied that El Salvador was in the middle of a civil war and that most of the country was a no-go area for UNICEF workers. Most people would have thought that was a reasonable answer. Jim's reply, said straight out, was, well, why don't they stop the war so they can immunize the kids? It was just the kind of remark that made people think he was unbalanced. In the following weeks, Jim Grant flew to El Salvador. he and the UNICEF staff in the country enlisted the help of the Catholic Church and met with both government and the guerrilla leaders. And within a few months, both sides in the civil war had agreed to call 3 separate days of ceasefire so the nation's children could be immunized. And this happened every year for several years until the war came to an end. And I just wanted to share that because I think that's the scale of what we're doing. All of these individual actions are all part of that same saying, the obstacles that have been put in our way are not real obstacles. They're not good excuses for not doing this. So I just want to thank everybody.
Great. Fantastic report, Joe. Ashley and everybody involved with the march, thank you for that. That was a real blow for freedom for everybody who went to New York, so thank you for everything everybody did. Okay, so the last thing we're going to do on today's call is go over the U.S. and Canadian actions. I am really, really excited about what we're doing this month. And so we'll go over what we're doing in the U.S. and Canada. LeMay Pettengill and I are going to go over the primary action, and then Steve will cover the rest of the U.S. and Canadian action. So, LeMay, can you come on for a second?
Hi, Mark.
I can hear you. Okay, very good. So one of the actions for this month is our fall fundraiser. We do we're a nonprofit, but we do 2 fundraisers a year, which is about 46 less than most of the organizations that send me emails. For instance, I got 3 from the Union of Concerned Scientists alone last Monday. So we do 2, and this is our fall one. I'm very excited about what we're doing. So just to put a little contrast of what we're trying to raise, some of the people who work on climate, NRDC, their budget every year is $100 million. EDF is $120 million. The Sierra Club is $157 million. Ours is $1.5 million. And even the organization that we patterned ourselves after, Results, their budget is over $9 million, and we're supporting twice the number of U.S. groups that they are. One of the things that I do every month is track our company's expenses. And if you look at our expense charts, they look just like the Keeling curve. So whether it's the conference line, the conference, the regional conferences, the going out and starting groups, our expenses go up as the organization continues to grow, and so we need to continue to raise money to support that. Lene, go ahead.
Right, so our budget 2 years ago was $451,000, and we had less than 2,000 volunteers. The budget for last fiscal year, which ended March 31st, was $986,000, and we had 4,800 volunteers. And you said the budget this year is $1.5 million. We're at more than 7,500 volunteers now, and we hope to have more than 10,000 volunteers at the end of the fiscal year.
Great. And clearly there's foundation money out there, but it's a long-term process that we started a couple years ago. We get 4% of our revenue from foundations, and when Lene and I talk to those foundations, it blows their mind. They can't believe that an organization is almost entirely supported by individuals.
Right, and our individual donors have done an amazing job so far, already giving $1 million this year, which is awesome, leaving us $500,000 to raise by March 31st. So I thought we should do something to celebrate if we can make our goal by the end of the calendar year. With that in mind, we're going to launch the Too Much CO2 Challenge. And if we can raise $500,000 before January 1st, what have you agreed to do, Mark?
Oh, I'm so excited about this. I have agreed to wear a tutu for the entire day, and because the office get a vote on it, and our entire office agrees that I look fabulous in black, I will wear a black tutu.
I'm sure you do. And whichever group has raised the most money by the time we hit $500,000 gets to give some input on what you do that day in your tutu. But even a regular day for you would be pretty entertaining, since you bike to work, you take a ferry from San Diego to Coronado, work in an office all day.
Yeah, so the bike part doesn't bother me at all. The ferry is the part, because I ride a ferry every day. I'm pretty good friends with everybody, and half of them are from the Navy. So let me just say, for the people like Gary Ruzinski from Boston and Grant Couch, who say that if they raise the most money, they get to say what I do, they're saying that if they raise the most money, I don't wear the tutu on the ferry. Come on, my brothers, I'm hoping you win this thing.
Well, we'll see, but any way they choose, there's lots of ways you can raise money. 2 of the most effective are just personal ask to your friends and family. And I'm not talking about a mass email or a post on Facebook, but a personal ask to an individual. There's lots of ideas on community. There's a presentation called Fundraising 101, as well as tutu making ideas. And your group might also be interested in holding some kind of fundraiser. Marshall Saunders, our founder, has done some incredibly successful fundraising events through Results, and he is willing to personally coach anyone who's interested in this option. So please feel free to reach out to him through the home office if you're interested in that.
Yeah, and I attended almost all of those. Almost, I think seven of them had over 100 people. One had over 200 people. They were all great, and my only regret was I didn't invite more people because I was always blown away. So if you want his personal input, great. Now, let me just say something to everybody who's listening. Nobody needs to do this. You should do this if it works for you, and it would add a particular element if it was fun or exciting to you. You know, the way we calculated it out is we have over 200 groups now. So if every group raised $2,500, that would raise to $500,000. But I think that there's some groups that should opt out because this isn't the right thing for you. If you relate to this like this is something you have to do, please opt out. We only want people to do this who it looks like it would be a real opportunity and possibly even some fun to do so.
Right. In addition to the team fundraising that we're doing through the groups who opt to do it, we're also hoping the challenge will go viral because that would mean not only more money raised, but also could bring in quite a few new volunteers. And the more volunteers we have, the quicker we're going to get legislation passed. So when you donate to the challenge, if you feel like it, you could post a video of yourself in a tutu on your social media sites, tagging others to donate too. And when you set up your fundraising page on the Stay Classy platform, it's possible to post a video, but it is a little technically challenging. It's going to be a lot easier to post that video through Facebook, just a little inside tip there. And then just one other thing, we're also hoping to get a celebrity involved to help make this go viral. We're going to focus on Leonardo DiCaprio, sending him a whole bunch of tweets on a 3-hour time frame on Tuesday. Details about that and all aspects of the Too Too Much CO2 Challenge are in the action sheet. And you're also going to be receiving an email letter today about the challenge asking you to donate. And if you need any assistance or your group needs any assistance as you're setting up fundraising pages, please go to CCL Community to the forum called Fundraising Help Desk. Thank you so much for your help and for your generous support.
Great. Thank you, Lynnae. Really nice. Okay, Steve Ball, can you tell us the other, the Canadian actions, which are all organized around the November conference, and then also the two other things we're doing in the U.S.?
Can you hear me, Mark?
Yep, go ahead.
Great. Okay, so up in Canada, the big thing, obviously, that's going on up there is the conference in Ottawa in November, and so the actions this month are geared toward that conference. The first action is to secure a lobbying session for Citizens Climate Lobby with your member of parliament for November 24th or 25th in Ottawa, and consider inviting your MP to the conference and reception as well. Second action is in April and again in July, we ask you to work on MP dossiers. Please send your dossiers by Friday, October 10th to reports@citizensclimatelobby.ca. And then, of course, whatever you can do to get the word out about the conference, please invite your friends, get public service announcements on local radio stations, and also keep in mind that you must book your hotel room for the conference by October 22nd. So those are the actions up in Canada. And the other actions here in the U.S., besides the fundraiser, is the first is to invite congressional offices to attend either the House or the Senate briefing on the REMI study, which will be presented by Scott Nystrom. In the Senate, the briefing will be hosted by Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington. It will be held in the Small Business Committee hearing room on November 19th at 10 a.m. And over in the House, Representative John Larson of Connecticut will host a briefing on November 20th, and the time and the room for that will be determined later. So there will be a Dear Colleague letter about the briefing that will be sent out in a few weeks. We hope to have both Republicans and Democrats on that letter. But in the meantime, we want CCL liaisons to contact congressional offices so that they can get it on their calendars. Now, the last action is to go ahead and have an outreach event this month in your community. There's been a lot of energy that was generated by the Climate March and the Climate Summit up in New York. This is a good time to have an outreach event, and we list some suggestions in the action sheet. One of those suggestions is something that we're doing here in Atlanta. We call it the CCL Social and Action. And what we did was we worked with Manuel's Tavern here in Atlanta, and they have a private room there, and you can get it for free. We booked it, and we had people come, and we had a great time just, you know, having drinks and eating and socializing. And somewhere about halfway into our social, we got out pens and papers and generated letters to our members of Congress. So it's a great way to spend a little social time that you might not get during your meetings, you know, with your members, and also bring in new people to the group and generate letters. So that was one of the things that we did here in Atlanta. But just try to figure out what you'd like to do some outreach in your community this month.
Okay, really nice, Steve. Thanks. Okay, a couple last things, everybody. You know, a lot of people inside the organization see there's something needs to be dealt with that's not dealing with. A new group was called Team Ocean was created this month. You can join that on CCL Community. So once again, fantastic job of somebody saying we need a team about the ocean. We've got that team, and we've got good people leading it. And if you're someone who wants to or should be part of that team, go to CCL Community and join it. And I want to mention something about Team Oil. You know, I think that if you're like me, you have people in your life who everything that goes wrong, they blame on the government. The government this, the government that. And I find that an extremely lazy and sloppy but unfortunately effective argument. And the reason it's lazy and sloppy is because the government can't ever answer back. Individuals could, or people inside departments could. And one of the things that our Team Oil has been very, very disciplined about is not demonizing the industry, but rather talking to people. And where that's led them to is this week, Peter Fukowski, the head of Team Oil, flew to London and met with David Hone, who's the climate change advisor for Shell. So David Hone is going to come on one of our calls and talk about carbon pricing from the perspective of oil companies, and that's because rather than doing the kind of lazy, sloppy, demonizing a group or a category, they chose to talk to individuals, and I think it's as an organization, it's one of the things that we should always be disciplined about is talking about individuals and speaking with individuals, not demonizing swaths of people.